Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. The Jeffrey Epstein story has been making headlines for days. Epstein, the extraordinarily wealthy and influential financier and jet setter who was arrested Saturday and charged with the sex trafficking of dozens of minors. However, Epstein's alleged activities have been the stuff of speculation for years. And in 2007, he agreed to plead guilty to two state charges for which he spent 13 months in a Florida jail. The deal was secret and allowed Epstein to avoid federal prosecution and a possible life sentence. We'll get an update on the latest case. And then later this hour, we focus on the plight of those caught up in sex trafficking. But first, Vicki Ward joins us. She's an investigative reporter and editor-at-large for HuffPost and has researched the Epstein case extensively. Vicki, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So Jeffrey Epstein is rich, he's powerful, he's connected. His alleged activities have been the focus of talk and rumor for a long time. Why does this case seem to be breaking open now?
Frankly, I think because the culture has changed and the political environment has changed. I mean, what was striking about the indictment that was unsealed on Monday in New York was that, you know, many of the charges in it were familiar to all of us who've been following Jeffrey Epstein for well over a decade. The difference was the reaction to them. You know, I think that were it not for the brilliant reporting by Julie Brown in the Miami Herald last year, who took, I mean, I think what's important to remember is that she didn't take a new story. She took old stories. She went and interviewed victims who had been victimized, you know, many years ago in the case that was, you know, that had a ridiculous outcome back in 2008. And, you know, she gave these women airtime. She took them seriously, as did her editors. And it was quite clear from reading that, you know, the trauma had stayed with them through the years. And I think it's against that backdrop that then Congress wakes up, and credit has to be given to, you know, the Republican Senator Ben Sasse for joining with 15 Democrats and saying, wait a minute, how could, you know, these women have been abused like this? And this man got away with this absurd 13-month cushy sentence, that, you know, in a county jail from where he could work and go for walks. You know, what was going on in the Justice Department? And, you know, as we know, a judge then ruled that the Justice Department broke the law, you know, but when that plea deal was struck and the victims were not informed of it.
Vicki.
But it's against that backdrop that I think the FBI felt emboldened to start this new investigation.
Alex Acosta, the current labor secretary, was the U.S. attorney in Florida who oversaw the case that you've referenced. There are now calls, you know, as you've heard, for Acosta to resign as labor secretary. He is defending the deal. What have you learned about Acosta's reasons for coming to the non-prosecution deal?
Well, yeah, I have more than one source on this, okay? And yeah, obviously, I can't reveal who they are. But he was definitely under the impression, and he told other people at the time, that he, you know, Jeffrey Epstein was above his pay grade, that he had been told, and we don't know by whom, that Jeffrey Epstein belonged to the intelligence community. And to let this one go. And I listened to his press conference yesterday, and it's still, it doesn't add up. You've got an FBI investigation. You've got the notion that of a federal crime, if, you know, with sex trafficking, bringing women, young underage women, across state borders. You don't just let that go with a slap on the wrist.
Two huge points of contention about the 2007 deal. It was secret. Victims did not know about it. Alleged victims didn't know about it.
Right.
And there was the agreement not to prosecute on the federal level. So moving forward to the case today, Epstein's
right.
defense team is apparently going to try to use this to argue that the current case needs to be thrown out. An agreement by federal prosecutors in Miami means federal prosecutors in New York cannot proceed with their case. Any sense of how the prosecutors in New York might try to get around this?
No, I mean, I think they've already been very clear. I mean, the Southern District of New York is, you know, famously aggressive and doesn't bring cases that it thinks it can't win. You know, and I think you've already heard the argument that what happened in Florida has no bearing here. I mean, my sources also tell me that there are new victims involved. And as a result of the indictment on Monday, new victims appearing every day.
Epstein,
so I think Jeffrey Epstein is going to have great difficulty running away from those.
He has a bail hearing Monday, this coming Monday,
yeah.
Asking for a little bit of an observer speculation here. Do you think that with his many jets and many homes around the world and the tenor of the times, Vicki Ward, that he will be granted bail? What do you think might happen?
Well, look, I mean, you know, it is speculation, as you say, but I would
sure.
be amazed. I would be amazed because I think that everybody knows, including Alexandra Acosta. You know, he said it yesterday, that Jeffrey Epstein is a very bad man and he needs to go to prison. And why would you give him the opportunity to flee?
At one point, years ago, when you reported for Vanity Fair, Vicki, you interviewed Epstein. What were your initial impressions?
So, you know, we played sort of cat and mouse because this was a man who had really avoided media for reasons that should be fairly obvious, right? But it wasn't just the women, though. It was also, you know, he didn't really want anyone poking around into how he had really made his money. And so what I disliked about him right from the get-go was that I felt he was trying to control the peace, both by threatening me and then sort of saying, well, threatening me and threatening my unborn children. I was pregnant with twins at the time, and then saying, well, that's off the record. But also by getting very important people, like then Jimmy Cain, who was then the CEO of Bear Stearns, which was then a very, you know, significant investment bank, to phone me unsolicited. At one point, he even got my then husband's boss, happened to be his uncle, but it was his boss, to phone me. Well, that's, you know, you're pregnant with twins. When your husband's boss phones you, sort of implicitly warning you to stay away from Jeffrey Epstein, that's not good. You know, that's a family paycheck involved. And I found him, you know, the charm, I remember writing, never, he tried to be charming, but the smile never really reached his eyes. And he was angry that I was writing this piece. He was angry that I started to uncover things he didn't like. And it really became a battle between us.
Epstein is again, he's connected with powerful the political names, including former President Bill Clinton and the current occupant of the White House, Donald Trump. Is it your sense that Epstein and Trump were ever, you know, really close? It seems they had a falling out 15 years ago.
Yeah. So I would think that they would have been party buddies. You know, again, you know, they do have women in, you know, common, and we've seen the photograph of them together. But, you know, I've written books. You know, I know the president, and I haven't had the sense, actually, that they were remotely close, certainly not since Jeffrey Epstein went to jail.
We are talking to investigative reporter Vicki Ward, and Vicki, we have a question from Irene who asks, what about the lawsuit against Trump and Epstein? It was dropped before the election.
Yes, it was.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, there was a woman who came forward. I think her name was Katie Rogers or something like that, and claiming that Epstein had introduced her to Donald Trump, I believe. And it did just
disappear.
Go away. Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know what? I am very sure, given what's going on today, that, you know, my colleagues are poking around, looking all over that. But I will tell you, of all the stories that are floating around, and, you know, people reaching out to me, other victims reaching out to me, social connections of Jeffrey Epstein reaching out to me, that story hasn't yet resurfaced.
And the challenge is trying to get to the truth of all that is floating around and all that is reaching you, correct?
Right.
How do you do that?
You just keep reporting. You get multiple sources. You know, you just... you know, I mean, I think that the interesting thing about... I think that the truth about Jeffrey Epstein will eventually come out. Because I think now, you know, so many of people are on it. He is no longer in the position of power that he has been. And so the people who protected him for so long, his social circle, you know, if they think they're going to be exposed now because of him, believe me, they'll start to talk.
Vicky, as you have reported, Secretary Acosta has tried to cut quite significantly a program in the Department of Labor, which in part works to combat human trafficking internationally. Tell us about this.
Yes, no, he has. I mean, you know, I think that people thought that Alexander Acosta, on one level, did what he needed to yesterday, which was probably placate the president, right? Who thinks he's doing a very good job and will view this as an enormous headache. And he was very pugnacious on this point, right? He really defended his record when it came to trafficking. I just think that the stink of history on this one is maybe something he just cannot outrun, no matter how plausible and how smooth he came across in that press conference. The substance of what happened in 2008, it's just really problematic for him.
Vicky Ward, thank you so much for joining us and for bringing us up to speed. Obviously an ongoing story, and we'll be keeping track of it. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Vicky Ward is an investigative reporter and editor-at-large at HuffPost. In just a few moments after our break, we're going to be talking about sex trafficking in our region. Our three guests will discuss how to fight it, how to recognize someone being trafficked, how to report and support the issue and support survivors, I should say. Mary DeFesco is a public defender in Philadelphia. Rosario Sanchez, a forensic nurse at Rutgers School of Nursing in Newark. And Tammy McDonald, a survivor and advocate with Covenant House. And that discussion is just ahead here on Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Do stay with us for that. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. We began the show by getting an update on the case of Jeffrey Epstein, the wealthy financier facing charges related to the alleged sex trafficking of dozens of minors. For the rest of the hour, we're going to focus on those who are victimized by sex trafficking, the psychological impact, how to recognize when someone is being trafficked, how to support survivors, and how sex trafficking affects our region. Tammy McDonald is a survivor of sex trafficking and an advocate with Covenant House. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Mary DeFusco is director of training at the Defender Association of Philadelphia and co-founder of Dawn's Place and the project Dawn Court, which help women who survive commercial sexual exploitation. Good to have you with us, Mary.
Thank you, Mary. Pleasure being here.
And Rosario Sanchez is a forensic nurse and doctoral candidate with the Rutgers School of Nursing in Newark, who has done extensive research into this issue. Welcome, Rosario.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So before we begin our discussion, I'd like to get the number out, 888-477-9499, if you'd like to call in, or you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Mary, let's begin with you. The definition of sex trafficking.
Well, I think people are becoming more aware, at least I hope they are, that sex trafficking has nothing to do with borders. A lot of people seem to think, well, these are people sex trafficked into the country or sex trafficked in some other country. There really isn't a whole heck of a lot of difference between trafficking, pimping, prostitution. This is all one large, seamless garment.
So when we say trafficking, what do we mean then?
So when we say trafficking, essentially what we mean is a woman who, because of an imbalance of power, sometimes because she was a child when this began and she got caught into this cycle and couldn't get out, sometimes because it actually used force, but for many different reasons, is stuck in this situation. And what she has is either a person behind her, the pimp, who's hiding, who's forcing her, right? Or she has a bunch of buyers who are paying no attention to her status because they just see her as an object.
And some men too. Sometimes men as
yes,
well.
Yes, and sometimes men as well. Absolutely.
So Tammy, let's get to your story. You were a victim of sex trafficking.
I was. So my story, it's a lot of people think of sex trafficking and they think of the movie Taken, you know, where the girl comes in, she's kidnapped and brought overseas. That's not how my story is. My story, you know, it happened in a neighborhood auto body repair shop. And I was a heroin addict, so I was extremely vulnerable. I was also unstable with housing, so he had offered me a job as a secretary. So that was my way. That was my escape. He also offered me to stay, like live in the office, because it was kind of set up like an apartment attached to the repair shop. So, you know, he put on this facade where I was working for him for about a month, and then things took a turn for the worst, and he started telling me in order for me to get paid so I could feed my drug habit, or if he was going to buy me the drugs, I had to sleep with him. And being in a vulnerable position, you know, it started as like a survival. I was trying to feed myself along with my addiction. Have a place to stay, you know, shelter. So it turned into, you know, not just him, but I had to, I was forced to have sexual encounters with the men in the office. Sometimes they would lock the door and it would be multiple people at once. Yeah. The one guy was from Brazil and he was like trying to get me to marry him. But I couldn't, just so he could get like a legal status.
Okay.
And I told him I couldn't because I was already legally married to my son's father. And, you know, I got punished for that, locked in a storage closet, you know, physically assaulted, all kinds of vicious acts.
What was going on emotionally while you were going through
I was
this?
Shut down. I was completely shut down.
So you weren't feeling anything, you were numb?
I was completely numb, you know, on top of having to separate myself from where my life was at that point, because I wasn't raised like that. I was raised in a good home. And so I had to separate myself from where my life had taken me and the position that I was in. And also the drugs had helped to not feel anything that was going on.
Well, Tammy was speaking, Rosario Sanchez, I saw you nodding your head. She was talking mm-hmm. about what was going through, you know, her emotionally, what she
yes.
was experiencing.
I mean, each survivor has their own experience. We attempt to understand them because we cannot be the experts of what they're going through. So as a nurse, it's each person that comes in and I have common quarrels with has their own story. And it's their story, their own. There's nothing that I could do or change that, but I could help them rehab, you know, rehabilitate through talking to them, through building trust. The psychological impact, especially when they are young, is too much for them. Imagine yourself, you are an adolescent. What were you thinking of? To play outside maybe with friends? To have maybe a party with your friends? Now you are captured by a trafficker, and all he inflicts is pain, fear, violence, and that's all you know. Now, at that age, when the brain is developing, because we have neuroplasticity at that time in the adolescent period, all you know is that pain. So when we get survivors that have been going through adolescence and they have suffered this pain, it takes a long time to heal. It takes a long time to build back who they were before.
Mary DeFesco?
Absolutely. One of the reasons that I co-founded Dawn's Place is because there's a misunderstanding in the criminal justice system that sees prostitution as a free will enterprise that's really being driven by drugs. If you just give this woman some drug treatment, she'll be fine. But the problem is, and we've seen it over and over again, that these women would be arrested over and over again, get drug treatment, get out of drug treatment, get arrested again, go to jail, or spending an enormous amount of time in jail, and drug treatment alone just doesn't cut it. They need sexual trauma recovery therapy because they were subjected to a huge amount of trauma, and specifically sexual trauma. If that's not addressed, they're not going to be able to get out.
Tammy, how did you break away?
I was in jail. I ended up getting locked up, and for me at the time, I remember it was like probably about 2 weeks prior to that happening. I was praying to God, I need to go to jail. Like, I just need to go to jail. It was my only way out. That's all I could see, because I didn't know any other resources. I didn't know who to reach out to. And even if I did, I was too scared to, you know. So being locked up, it was just like my saving grace for me, because I didn't see any other way out. And I ended up going to jail in New Jersey, and I was unfamiliar with the area. I'm not from Jersey. I was out in Atlantic City. I mean, I got arrested with no shoes on and released with no shoes on.
What about family support at the time?
My family didn't want anything to do with me at that point. My parents live in Georgia, and my sister had adopted my kids, and they had enough. They had enough of, they didn't know actually what was going on. They just thought I was a drug addict, and that was it.
Rosario, in your research, you've looked at the relationship that can develop between young people who are sold for sex and the criminals who traffic them. Hard to believe, but a bond can actually develop between them. And I'm guessing sometimes, even in a case like yours, Tammy, where there's no family supporting, yes, given up on you, that these people can become their family in a twisted way.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Because so I research a lot, and when I talk to survivors, they talked about this bond that they had that they couldn't break away, an invisible tie, they called it. And I started to explore what was it like. And what I found was that the trafficker is a very smart person. Disgustingly how he is, he's very smart. So there are things that he will do to a victim, such as social isolation. And not only from their family members, from the other trafficked girls. So there is not a camaraderie among them. So they are alone. One of the ways that he will use is a psychological influence in being nice to them and being violent to them. So they don't know what constitute love or what constitute kindness. So there's a confusion that goes on. And on top of it, there is the power that I am in control. You're an object and you belong to me. So these three things makes the victim realize that their perceived escape is not even visible to them. And that bond is so strong. This is why sometimes when we have survivors come in, they will not rat out their traffickers. They will not do it. One, they were too young when they got in. So imagine you being with this trafficker who at least provides you food, who at least provides you, like what Tammy had, drugs, right? And now you're going to be alone. And the first thing he's going to tell you, who's going to provide for you? No one. Nobody wants you. Your family doesn't want you. No one wants nothing to do with you. You are alone. You are mine. And that's all the trafficker has to do. It's a psychological impact. And that trauma bonding, which I said is not so much a trauma bonding, it's a coerced trauma bonding. It's forced into that victim based on primal fear.
Mary DeFesco, how do you even begin to separate?
Well, it's a very difficult thing. I remember one of our early women in the Project Dawn Court actually had gotten into a relationship with a guy when she was 15 and he was 36. So she was engaging in survival sex. He was essentially her entree into this world. She was in her 40s when we first met her, being arrested over and over again 22 times. And many, many drug and alcohol programs, all to no avail. And the court system had essentially given up on her. She got the sexual trauma recovery therapy that she needed. But as she began in that court, this guy was going to jail in upstate New York. Who knows what he had done? But she actually went up to visit him.
Well, is there,
decades later, she actually went up to visit him. And it wasn't until she had completed all the sexual trauma recovery therapy over a period of years that she was able to say, wait a minute, what the heck? You know, so that bond is there. It's very real. And it makes it so difficult for women to get out.
So what I'm hearing then is that if there is, and let's talk about children, minors versus people who are adults. If there is a strong bond and the person who's being trafficked does not want to leave the trafficker as an adult, legally, is there anything you can do?
There's very little that you can do. I don't think there is anything you can do legally. What you can try to do is try to persuade the women to get into some type of therapy, because once they start to address the trauma, then they will start to see the reason for all of this behavior, and they will start to see the way out. But until they get it, they themselves don't know that there's something wrong with this. They're trapped in this situation. They can't get out. They don't know why they can't get out. They're desperate to get out. And they basically need some help, some support, and it's very difficult to get.
So let's talk about minors now. If you observe a situation which you are pretty sure that a minor is being trafficked, but that young person does not want to leave their trafficker, what legal recourse is there?
Well, I mean, if it's a minor under the Federal Anti-Trafficking Act, you don't even have to show force, fraud, or coercion.
What do you have to show? If somebody suspects that a minor is being trafficked,
essentially what you have to show is that somebody sold this person for sex, but you don't have to show that they were forced. You don't have to show that there was any coercion involved or any fraud involved. So it becomes a little bit easier to move against a trafficker if the person is a juvenile. The difficulty is, again, that you have to somehow get, and Rosario and I were talking about this before the show, you have to persuade the victim that they need to enter into talking to you about this. They need to open up a little bit about it. And it's a difficult thing. It's a very difficult thing to do. And that's why programs like Dawn's Place exist. But for instance, Dawn's Place is not funded by the government. It's all donations. And it's very difficult to keep that going day to day and day to day. If we didn't have such generous donors, we couldn't do it.
Tammy McDonald, when you were a victim of sex trafficking, you were an adult.
Yes.
So you mentioned earlier that when you'd gotten out of jail, you went in without shoes, you came out without shoes. You know, what stopped you from going back to the person who, even though he abused you, you know, the traffickers, as so many women tend to do, why did you, were you able to overcome the heroin addiction and see more clearly, or what was your story?
Well, when I got out of jail, it was in Atlantic City, so, and it was in the summertime, so while I was in jail, I was dead set on, I'm going to get out, and I'm going to kill myself. Like, that's it, I'm done. I was going to go somehow get some money and put a whole bundle into my arm at once and just end it all. I was determined. And when I got out, I was unfamiliar with the area. I didn't initially think I was going to go back to Philly because I was fearful and I had given up any hope of, like, there's nothing there for me. And then I realized, like, I was out for 6 days and I'm like, there's nothing here either. Like, it's the same thing, just in an unfamiliar setting. So I ended up panhandling enough money to take a bus back home to Philly. And instead of putting a bundle of dope in my arm, I went to a crisis center.
Why did you make that choice?
I don't know. I had met a girl out there, and she was also a homeless addict, and we started using together. She was showing me, like, where to go to get what or whatever, and we had gotten into a fight. And I had actually thanked her a couple years later. We had gotten into a fight, and she screamed at the top of her lungs, "Get out of here. You don't belong here. Go back home." And I walked away, and I'm like, she's right. And it was like this cosmic mental switch went off. I'm like, I'm done. And I went into the crisis center, and I slept in a bush outside of the crisis center, and because it was like late at night when I got there, and I was scared to go in. And then finally, I just got up and went in, and I never looked back. I ended up, my social worker really pushed for me. When I had called my sister when I got in and settled or whatever, to tell her that I was out of jail and I was in Philly and I wanted to talk to my kids or just to see how they were doing. And she had told me that my daughter's father had overdosed and died the day after I had gone into the crisis center. So essentially the day after I got sober, he had overdosed, and 2 days later he had died. The social worker really pushed, you know, substance abuse treatment, they don't give you time, and that, you know, you get your 28 days and you're back on the street and you're just barely getting going through withdrawal. And now you got to deal with, like, how are you going to live, survive? How are you going to pay your rent or eat? And you got to worry about money. Money's always a big issue. But I was blessed. My social worker got me approved for 9 months of long-term inpatient rehab. So I ended up going to an all-women's facility. And from there, I stayed there for 4 months, and the caseworker there had mentioned Dawn's Place and said that I would do really good there. And I had never heard of it. And I was like, at that point, I was willing to take any suggestions because I had nowhere to go. I just needed direction and guidance.
And today you are an advocate, and you also are the street outreach coordinator for Covenant House, which provides housing and services for homeless youth. So we're going to talk about that after the break. But Rosario and Mary, you're both nodding your heads. I'd also like to talk about, we do have the break coming up, but the fact that it seems that the survivor's safety net, the safety net for people who are trafficked, is so full of holes that it's
so
almost
true.
Impossible
so
for
true.
People to be able to climb out of this morass and move forward.
It is. I mean, the survivor services that we have now is not really doing justice for the survivors.
All right. We are talking about sex trafficking, how to recognize someone being trafficked, how to support survivors, how to fight sex trafficking. We'll be joined by our three guests after the break here on Radio Times. Keep it here. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're wrapping up this hour talking about sex trafficking victims and the services that are out there for them. Our guests this hour, Rosario Sanchez, is a forensic nurse and doctoral candidate at Rutgers School of Nursing in Newark. Tammy McDonald is a survivor of sex trafficking and an outreach coordinator now for Covenant House. And Mary DeFusco, director of training at the Defender Association of Philadelphia and co-founder of Project Dawn Court and also Dawn's Place. And we were just discussing during the break a little bit more of what we were talking about. And Rosario, you talked about the definition of commercial sex trafficking and that really
the act.
Tell us a little bit more of what you were talking about during the break.
So the federal law states that any person under the age of 18 forced into doing a commercial sexual act. And a lot of people have a misconception what that is. Everybody thinks it's only sex. But in a minor, it could be exposing the minor to pornography. It could be sexting. It could be doing things, making the minor do things that they don't want to do, such as massages, which happened in the latest case. These are things that need to be defined because a lot of people have this misconception that it's only the sexual act. Mm-hmm. No, it's more than that, specifically to a minor, because the minor has no sense of what is it that they're doing. So think about it. They have the mind that doesn't understand what's going on. An adult will know this is a sexual act, but a minor will not. That's why the federal law honing into the force fraud and coercion needs not to be proven in a case in a minor, somebody that is under the age of 18.
Correct. In researching an article about some proposed legislation to fight sex trafficking in Pennsylvania, I'd read that the average age a child is forced into sex slavery is 12 years old.
And even
correct.
Younger.
Mary? 12 to 14, absolutely. And again, that's just an average. But the umbrella term that we like to use is commercial sexual exploitation, mm-hmm. because it covers all of that. It covers stripping, pornography, mm-hmm. massages, everything. Because generally, when you see that kind of stripping, you'll hear a lot of survivors say, well, that's how I got involved in this. Mm-hmm. And it started with stripping, and then it went on, and then it became, you know, some form of prostitution, and she didn't realize the entire entire time that essentially what was happening is she was getting trafficked in.
Yeah. Tammy McDonald, again, you work with Covenant House. You're working with homeless youth. So are you seeing young people who are vulnerable to sexual exploitation?
Absolutely.
And what are you seeing? Who are you seeing? Tell us about them.
We just did a red flag study, and, you know, out of the youth that we see, 1 in 12 girls red flagged for having been trafficked at some point in their life, and 1 in 12 boys have also. So boys aren't excluded in this, although they're not talked about as much. You know, that you think of commercial sexual exploitation, you think it's being done to a woman, but it's happening to boys as well.
So the young people that you work with, do they come from homes that might be troubled?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what is the Runaways. Background that brings them to you at Covenant House?
Just broken homes. Maybe there's some violence, some kind of abuse going on. A lot of them are runaways. Majority of them have aged out of foster care.
And they have nothing else.
Yeah.
I'm rendered momentarily speechless. So let's go on to protections for these young people who find themselves in desperate situations in Pennsylvania. And I know, Rosaria, you said it in New Jersey as well, the Safe Harbor Law, which is relatively new.
Yes. Mary. So in Pennsylvania, the Safe Harbor Law went into effect at the end of December 2018, which means that it's really too early to tell in terms of its overall impact. But it's definitely a giant step forward, because what it's saying is that if you're under the age of 18, you cannot be arrested for prostitution. It's making a decision that if you're not old enough to consent, for instance, to sex, you're certainly not old enough to somehow make a free will determination that you're going to sell yourself.
So wait, so just for one moment. So before this law went into effect, say a 15-year-old could have been arrested?
Yes, juveniles were arrested for prostitution, absolutely.
Yeah. And so now the case is they cannot be arrested.
They cannot be arrested.
But are they then steered towards services that might be able to help
them? So the act also provides that they have to be, they can't be just locked up. So one of the things that would sometimes happen is, well, you're a juvenile and we see that you're a victim of trafficking, so we're just going to take you and keep you in this juvenile institution to keep you safe. Well, in essence, it's a prison, right?
And re-traumatizing.
It's very much re-traumatizing and drives the victim right back into the arms of the trafficker, which is what you're trying not to do. So the law prohibits that. But it does say that the funds that come from this law for the fines will essentially be used for housing and other services for the juveniles. Now, that leaves a big gap because as I like to say, that no one rings a magic bell when you hit 18 and suddenly frees you from the trafficker and all the trauma that he's inflicted upon you, and suddenly makes it possible for you to float your resume and get a job and do all the things you'd like to do if you could. So you're still trapped in there. And for that, there's really not a whole heck of a lot other than people out of their free will helping established places like Dawn's Place, supporting Dawn's Place and stuff like that. Other than that, there doesn't seem to be any systemic help.
Rosario, in your experience and in your research, what services, health services, mental health services are available to these people who find themselves in this situation?
So it's very difficult to say, because right now, I mean, in 2017, there were only 2,700 beds for human trafficking victims. That is not acceptable. I mean, they are sent to shelters that are maybe for domestic violence or sexual abuse. They need more help. The other thing is, her case, she was, you know, already a drug addict. But some victims, they are forced into drugs. Why? Yep. Because then the trafficker has more control to have them do whatever they have to. Or some of them, they just cannot cope and they start taking drugs so that they could go through every day of being sold over 15 times a day. Imagine that.
Yeah.
So now the problem is, once we get a bed, they want, well, she's a drug addict. We need rehab. And they won't accept them. So that's a big problem that we're having in New Jersey, is the treatment part of it. That some shelters do not accept patients that have drug habits. They have to go to rehab first, and then they go to a shelter.
Tammy, how were you able to get through? Did you find rehab when you were behind bars? I mean, how did you get treatment?
Well, I had a long run with drugs, so I was already in and out of treatment centers before, but you know, I was in 28 to 30 days, and then I was shoved right back out with no real therapy. It was just like the removal of drugs. So for me, I find it so important to first, you know, because it's a compound situation, you know, and for me, my personal experience, I needed to remove the drug and physically feel better, clear my mind in order for me to focus my attention on healing the trauma. Because once I jumped right into like, all right, now I'm sober or clean and I got to get the car, the house, the kids, the job, the this, the that. And then I never really focused on the trauma. And then, you know, it just all comes back up. And then all of a sudden I relapse again. I didn't have coping skills. So I had to remove the drug, take care of that problem first. For me, it's like they say, one step at a time. My first step was taking care of the drug problem before I could, when I transferred over to Dawn's place, then the healing process started. And I did a lot of trauma therapy. I did a lot of grief counseling. I mean, I was in therapy 4 days a week, you know, along top of my IOPs, my intensive outpatient for the substance abuse. So it was a compound issue. But to be overwhelmed with like everything at once within the first 20 to 30 days, you know, instantly sent me into a rehab every time. I mean, a relapse every time.
Well, thank goodness for places like Dawn's Place, but they are not funded.
They saved my life.
By federal dollars or state dollars.
Or city dollars.
Yeah. So are legislators aware of this need?
I think so. The legislature is becoming, as you can see from the legislation, I mean, this has been an issue. I've been a public defender 35 years. It's been an issue since day one, right? And only in the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years has there suddenly become some recognition, driven, I think, by foreign trafficked people, right? And then people started to realize, hey, wait a minute. You know, really, what's the difference between a woman trafficked from Korea and one pimped in Kensington? There really isn't any difference. So why don't we start doing something about it? So you see the difference in the legislation. Hopefully, more people are going to start seeing these women not as criminals, which is how criminal justice has traditionally treated them, but as victims and survivors, right? And the model is there. We know how to do it. They need a clean, caring place to live. They need sexual trauma recovery therapy over months, not 28 days, which is what they get for inpatient drug treatment here in the city. They need that environment so that they can do what Tammy's done. She's an amazing woman. She's an amazing survivor.
Thank you.
I smile every time I see her.
But before the show went on, you showed me kind of a small poster, Mary, about which tracks the way a person looks when they first start out and at the end of, say, what was it, like a year or something, a year's time. And the difference is obviously it's striking after somebody has been through such trauma. You know, they age 15 years in the sequence of photos. You know, people look awful when they're going through this. How do you, you know, when you're doing outreach, try to convince the rest of the public or, you know, lawmakers, you've got to spend some money on this to bring these folks back, to bring up some compassion? Because it's easy to not see people, I imagine. They can become invisible.
They do. They are very invisible inside criminal justice itself because they see only a drug addict. They're like, well, they just need a drug program. And then when they're sent to a drug program and they don't succeed and they fail again and they use again, so, well, you weren't serious.
Yeah.
You know, you've been lying to us. So now sit in jail for a while. All right, now I'll send you another drug program. Maybe you learned your lesson. And it's a cycle that just never seems to end. Until the woman suddenly starts to put together in her head that what was done to her at a very young age is not unrelated and very much related to what's going on in her life today, and she needs to get to the bottom of that and she needs the trauma therapy for it. But the drug and alcohol programs that have all been set up around the city, and you know, God bless them, it's great that we have them, if they're not funded for enough time, they're not going to get to that realization as Tammy did, because she managed by some miracle, wonderful social worker, to get to a really long-term inpatient drug and alcohol program, and then, of course, to Dawn's place.
And Rosaria Sanchez, you've been nodding your head there.
Yes, this is wonderful. I mean, I work with the New Jersey Coalition Against Human Trafficking, and what we did last year, working with the healthcare committee, we looked at the service providers for human trafficking and what sort of services they were given and what sort of benefits do they give the victims and survivors. So we're working on that to develop a database of services and to be able to have it on the internet so that a survivor or a victim could log in and could look at the services that are provided throughout New Jersey and get some specific information on how to reach out and to get help. That's what I've been working with the New Jersey Coalition. And then also I work with Covenant House Newark. And I work with the homeless, you know, the runaways. And a lot of the things that I do is health education, promoting healthy relationships, mindfulness for them. Because you know what? A lot of them, they just need guidance. They don't know what healthy is. And when they come out through the workshop that I do, they're like, wow, it makes sense. There's so much that we could do out there. Yeah. There's a lot of awareness. Cases like what is happening now with Epstein brings awareness. Yes, it's a high-profile case. Yes, it's that. But the public needs to know that sex trafficking, human trafficking, labor trafficking, all of the trafficking, because human trafficking is the umbrella. And then you have the other names. Now, the Polaris Project, which is the national resource for human trafficking, has developed basically two of them, 25 types. The big one will be sex trafficking because it's the largest in the United States, mm-hmm. and labor trafficking because it does happen here. So now we have sort of like an identification for it. And the Polaris Project, the National Human Resources for Human Trafficking, is a great start point for anybody to get help. They have all of these things for survivors and counselors 24/7.
Tammy McDonald, obviously you are boots on the ground as well, and you work with Covenant House. So again, yes. In helping to identify young people who might be in trouble, when you get that sense that somebody is struggling, and often, I think as was mentioned earlier, they are reluctant to talk about it.
Yeah.
How do you approach them as somebody who's been there and who survived it?
I have to just let them know, you know, if they don't want to talk, they don't have to, you know, I'll talk and I'll tell you where I've been and how I came out of it. And that there's hope after addiction and trauma. And I'm actually doing a documentary for the Salvation Army, which is called the Hope Documentary. So I'm really excited about that, but there is hope. And there is a way out. A lot of people, I'll never forget this one girl. She's like, I have no other choice. Like you do. And there wasn't much I could do. There wasn't much anybody could say to change her mind. She still left. But to plant
left
that,
to go back to her trafficker.
Yeah. Mm. And, you know, just to continue to plant the seed of hope, and that we're here to help and always keep an open door. And I'll always forever be grateful for the people who never gave up on me.
Yeah. And obviously you're here as living testament.
Yeah. Yeah. God willing, I'll have 4 years, September 3rd. Wow. 4 years.
Congratulations.
Out of the lights.
Congratulations. And you look beautiful.
Thank you.
All right. So as we only have about like 45 seconds left. So if somebody believes that a young person or a young adult or any adult really is in trouble with this, what do they do first?
Well, there's the National Trafficking Hotline.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They can call that number.
888-373-7888.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay.
Correct.
We'll put that up on our site at Radio Times.
Correct.
And Rosario?
You have to understand, I mean, as a healthcare provider, there is a lot of shame and guilt that victims of human trafficking go through. So they're not going to be able to talk to you about it because they have to also deal with what they did, the shame that comes in and all of that, and the guilt that they felt, they feel still, because how did they get caught up in this way? How did I not see it? This was an abuse.
But don't be afraid to take the steps.
That's right.
As a protector.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Well, Rosario Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time, unfortunately. Rosario is a forensic nurse and doctoral candidate with the Rutgers School of Nursing in Newark, who has done extensive research into the sex trafficking issue. Tammy McDonald, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tammy is now serving as an advocate with Covenant House. And Mary DeFusco, Director of Training at the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and also co-founder of Dawn's Place and Project Dawn Court. We appreciate your being with us as well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for today's Radio Times.